bright day for England and Wales, but further north across Scotland and Northern Ireland, further wet and windy weather arrives, and then we do it all again. A stormy spell of weather then returns on Friday, gradually pushing its way south and east. That rain will linger across southern England for much of Saturday. That's your forecast.
All right, many thanks, Louise Lear. Our book of the week is Darling Munster, letters written from Lady Diana Cooper to her son, John Julius Norwich, who introduces some of that correspondence. The year is 1947. Winston Churchill has kept his word and installed Diana and her husband, Duff Cooper, in the British Embassy in Paris. The letters are read by Patricia Hodge.
Paris, February the 3rd. Laurence Olivier and Vivian Lee are staying with us. We are very fond of them. I've seen all the sketches for the Hamlet film, and they're wonderful. Vivian is to play Ophelia. She really is a beauty on a minute scale, and she is as sincere and good as her face proclaims. Cecil Beaton is in bed with the flu and still sneezing away. Papa read short stories by Elizabeth Bowen aloud to us while I stitched myself a gypsy skirt of silk. And for dinner, six of us went to Elsie Mendel's house at Verrières. A game of charades was played afterwards, and the Oliviers acted worst. Larry Olivier, rather too well oiled, was quite awful to our old friend Juliet, talking to her as one might to a disobedient dog, authoritative. Very amusing for us, I'm ashamed to say, but I hope she did not notice it too much. February the 10th. Now we come to last night's dinner. The Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin said goodnight at about 11:30. I looked desperately round for his principal private secretary, Bob Dixon, to guide him into the lift. Bob had vanished, comme le camphor. So I piloted him myself. What was my nearly great surprise when he suddenly clasped me into his arms with the strength and immobility of a bear and buried his podgy face in my neck. So we stood for a full minute, or an eternity, then with a very slow, utterly relentless gesture, he shifted his mouth to mine. No struggles could have affected the situation. As well stand up against the mountain weight of lava. I was agonized at the thought of Bob Dixon coming in and writing me down as an office hunter seducing the boss. But as far as I know, he did not see anything, unless it was the lipstick that transformed poor Ernie into an end-of-the-evening old clown Joey. He asked me to stay the night. Could he have thought I would? Still, there's life in the dear old dog, and courage and character and humanity and a lot of other nice things, and if he likes to be foolish late at night, he should be indulged. Not one word to a soul about Ernie.
Not until now. Paris had been liberated by the Allies in August 1944, and my father was thrilled to be appointed as the first post-war British ambassador to France. This was the best job he could ever have asked for. He loved France, he spoke beautiful French, and could discuss its history and literature for hours. My mother was a good deal less keen. The prospect of being British ambassadress in Paris was daunting indeed. She'd never enjoyed grandeur for its own sake. Left to herself, she would infinitely have preferred to return to Bognor and her little farm. But once installed in the embassy, she certainly made the best of it. This is how she and my father first arrived in Paris in September 1944.
Darling Munster, we rose in a moment, a beautiful aeroplane, that Dakota, swift and silent. I could recognise nothing of England till we came to the coast, and a dazzling white beachy head lapped by emerald waves then proclaimed itself. Like an artistic poster for Albion it was, and I was moved. More moved than on crossing into France. Here, we all skinned our eyes for flying bomb sites and shell holes and devastated towns. I'm bound to say I didn't see a lot. Soon, we were circling over Paris itself, and all around, dipping and diving and soaring like swallows, are 45 escort Spitfires. Down we came to the little group of friends and diplomats knotted together on a completely bashed-up aerodrome. We drove the 12 miles into Paris at a snail's pace, with a dozen police on motorcycles. The people in the street, hearing the clatter, mostly stopped and waved, or raised their hats. and workmen in groups would even raise a cheer. This was encouraging to my rather feeble spirits. This held good for the heart of Paris, but here are added in the Champs-Élysées a lot of very old horse fiacres waiting for custom but too expensive to hire. The streets are hung and the windows are dressed with Allied flags, but there seems no ray of gladness or gaiety in the atmosphere. No cinemas, no theatres on account of electricity, or cafes or restaurants because of food, except fabulously expensive black market ones, accounts for it, I suppose. We laid a wreath without hesitation on the unknown soldier's grave at the Arc de Triomphe. After lunch, we went to look the embassy over. It's vast and makes my heart sink.
At Christmas 1946, I left Eton. In those days of compulsory national service, I had been accepted into the Royal Navy, but my call-up couldn't occur before my 18th birthday the following September, and so we agreed that I should put in 6 months or so at the University of Strasbourg.
Paris, January 1947. I miss you terribly. Will you have enough to do? If no classes or lectures are obligatory, and if there is no examination to work for, should you not have some coaches who will take you privately 2 or 3 hours a day? I wonder how cold it is. Here one is curled and shriveled by the temperature, roads icebound, and very little heating. You must see a world of women before you pick one, and don't get picked yourself, especially not in the street or bar. They'll contaminate and deceive you, and most probably give you diseases of all kinds, and so méfiez-vous now you're on your own, and keep yourself and your love for something or somebody almost exactly like me, with a happier disposition.
During their marriage, my mother had had one or two light-hearted affairs, but my father was the only man she really loved. He, on the other hand, had had a great many throughout their married life, but she never minded so long as the object of his affections met with her approval. One of my father's great loves, the novelist and poet Louise de Villemorin, was even given a room of her own at the embassy. My mother loved her almost as much as my father did, to the point where Parisian gossips were speculating on a threefold relationship. This it was not, although Louise returned my mother's love in a similar degree. I once asked my mother whether she really minded about all my father's affairs. She replied, "Why should I mind, darling, if they made him happy? I always knew. They were the flowers. I was the tree."
London, January the 9th, 1948. Yesterday it was Brighton for the day, a jaunt for Papa and me, Evelyn Waugh, Daisy Fellows and Lord Sherwood. We piled into the Southern Bell at 11. Lord S. travels with a large-sized bottle of Worcester sauce in his pocket to lace his Bovril. The idea made my mouth water for so delicious a reviver, and my disappointment was acute when the attendant said they'd run out this morning. With 7 minutes to go before 11, my weak condition still allowed me to tear down the platform, bluffing and thrusting to the tea buffet. "A small pot of Bovril, please, quick, quick. Can't serve you till you're seated. I've no time to sit, just a little pot of Bovril, please, quick. I'm sorry, you must sit down." So I plumped onto a chair, divorced from its table, looking grotesque, and again panted my request. "No good, no Bovril. Off again to lunch buffet." "Any Bovril?" "Yes, if you'll sit down, we'll give you a cup." "No, just a pot, small, please, quick, quick." "I'm sorry, we're not allowed to sell it that way." Screaming something about this country in frustration and Labour government, I tore back and just hopped the moving train. Droitwich Spa Health Farm, January the 27th, 1948. I'm here on retreat for 3 weeks, enclosed in a nutshell, for it's no bigger. Bright and flowery, and a very high hospital bed. I'm really curiously calm and happy, and I believe it's what I need. Absolute cessation from strain, food, faces, drink, fluster. My luggage caused laughter. One big white box of clothes, books, and so on. 2 large black tin boxes of letters. 1 Foreign Office bag stuffed with letters and books. 1 attaché case. 1 zip bag. I've been going through the old papers and letters. I've got a very amusing packet of anonymous letters, love and hate, for you. I wish I'd kept more. I've had literally thousands. I found a cable offering me £15,000 for 12 weeks cinema contract from D.W. Griffith, the man who made the first gigantic pictures, Birth of a Nation and so on. Why did I not accept? I suppose it was war. Or did my nerve fail? Or was it family veto? No date on the cable. And I've read the correspondence of Gustav Hamel, the first man I loved, an airman, Swede by origin, who fell into the Channel in his cardboard monoplane in 1914, and whom London society, England, and quite a slice of the world mourned. He was missing for days and days, and during the period of anxiety before resignation set in, big balls were postponed, friends wept in the street, and Papa wrote a beautiful poem published in the Times. Then I read the few poor letters of Basil Hallam, another famous star, a gent who danced and sang at the Palace Theatre in high-class revues. With him I had a passionate walkout, and we used to go to these parties. He danced like a skater and with humour. After all, he was paid hundreds of pounds a week for letting people watch him, and I adored him. He used to drive me home at 4 or 5 a.m, and we'd spoon and be very serious and say we loved each other. I don't think I ever said so, really. The words always stuck in my throat till I was much older. But we'd drive round and round Regent's Park in a taxi and hate to leave each other. The little room on wheels was a girl's only setting to be alone with a dear one. He had very little conversation, but acknowledged charm. It all ended. Basil was not accepted for the army because of veins. It seemed extraordinary that he should dance and be unable to march. But so it was. He could, of course, have sat in an office in a railway station, but I suppose they really wanted him to carry on at the palace and delight the boys on leave. Public opinion got too critical. I got anonymous letters saying I was a traitor to my country in holding young men like him away from their patriotic duty. He went into the Balloon Corps, what corresponded in those days to blimps, not for defence, but for observation. Captive, of course. Poor Basil was sick all the time. Then the enemy shot his balloon, he jumped in his parachute, and it ended. Because it didn't open. London, April the 27th, 1948. Yesterday we went to the silver wedding anniversary service of the King and Queen at St Paul's, the sun always shining on the scant flags and happy, happy crowds. I wore a new Christian Dior new look dress and picture hat to cover my cyst, and Papa, dressed to kill, got rattled at being frustrated by the traffic police. Outside the cathedral, the sun doubled the glory of the heralds, half gold, and the palace band, all gold, and the old gentleman at arms, and a, to me, new posse of city pikemen. Superb, straight from Covent Garden's Faust, yet real, with real steely armour in ribs on their torsos, lace collars on the armour, steel helmets brimming over with ostrich, and pikes 3 times their own height. I hated to leave the colour for the dark cathedral, for after passing the beef-eaters in their legion, we, of course, sat in places from which I saw nothing. The choir had no strength, neither had the organ, unless supported by the military. When I say I saw nothing, I saw Queen Mary burning bright in green gold, and a suggestion of blue which I took to be the Queen and her princesses. There was the usual hopeless getaway, lost cars, flustered owners. All the men wore very ill-fitting tailcoats. The younger ones made do with their fathers, and the older ones had shrunk or bulged into deforming theirs. After dinner, off to the palace for a spot of cheering. We didn't have to wait long before they were all out on the balcony. But it's too far away. They are such specks, and the diamonds can't glitter at that distance.
Darling Munster was read by Patricia Hodge with John Julius Norwich. It was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast is next. Until then, here's Sailing By. Now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 19th of December. There are warnings of gales in all areas. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Rockall 954, expected southeast Iceland 943 by midday Thursday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North at Sarah, South at Sarah, 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. Southeasterly, veering southwesterly, severe gale 9 or storm 10, decreasing 6 to gale 8. Rain, then squally showers, moderate or good, occasionally poor. Fisher, German Bight, Humber. South or southeast, veering southwest, 7 or gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9 at first, except in German Bight, decreasing 5 to 7.